1990. The U.S. immediately was prepared. It went right to the U.N., had all the resolutions in place. These are things that usually take weeks or months, even in a crisis. They, within 48 hours, they got a sanctions resolution against Iraq. And by a week after the invasion, 50,000, the first 50,000 of what was to be 550,000 U.S. troops were on their way. This was a well, the U.S. had prepared for this and wanted to set up a situation where they could be seen in a good light, where they could have public opinion behind them, to really launch an attack that would devastate Iraq.
Now, the United States did wage this huge bombardment campaign, and then people like Timothy McVeigh and Nichols, and these people got to drive their Bradley fighting machines through the desert and so on. Can you kind of give us a breakdown? Like, was it a pretty equal battle where about the same number of U.S. troops were killed as Iraqis? Or how did that work out?
Well, you would have thought that that was what was going to happen if you listened to the corporate media leading up to the Gulf War. They created an image that Iraq was the fourth most powerful military in the world. This was said over and over and over again, that it had a huge number of troops and tanks and artillery and so on and so forth. But, of course, this was ludicrous, because how could a developing country of 20 million people, which Iraq was at that time, be the fourth most powerful military in the world? There was no way that that was possible. Iraq had a very weak air force, and really, as I say, the most important thing is that it's really a developing country. And this was proven when the war took place itself, because the best estimates that we have of how many Iraqis died in the, I think it was about 43 days that the combat actually lasted, is about 150,000 to 200,000. It was a high-tech war, mainly fought from afar. And the U.S., British, French forces, who did most of the combat, and of course the U.S. forces were the main ones, had the highest tech weaponry in history. And they sat generally offshore or flew in overflies that were completely protected from what Iraq had to hit back at them. So compared to the 150,000 to 200,000 Iraqi dead, U.S. military casualties were 148 killed. I mean, we're talking about a ratio of 1,000 to 1. And about a third of the U.S. casualties were what is called friendly fire. They were killed by their own soldiers. So it was not a war, really, in that sense. It was a slaughter. It was a high-tech slaughter, the use of high-tech weaponry against a country that was basically defenseless in the face of that weaponry. And even then, when the war ended, after all this death and devastation in Iraq, the sanctions were kept in place, have been kept in place, as I said, for, this is almost 8 years now, and the casualties from the sanctions are now seven times or eight times what the casualties were from the Gulf War itself. And this is a weapon. This is an instrument. The sanctions, the blockade, is an instrument of mass destruction. It is a weapon of mass destruction. It's used every day. It kills every day, and it costs the United States very little. We should point out, though, that it has to be to work. It has to be militarily enforced, and it is militarily enforced. All the ships that travel in the Persian Arabian Gulf are searched. All the ships that went into Jordan's port of Aqaba were boarded and searched by the U.S. Navy. So billions of dollars a year is spent to enforce this blockade against Iraq, and it is enforced by military means. And I think that just reinforces our point that the war against, from the Iraqi point of view, the war never ended.
Right, it's just continuing to this day. Now, you are saying that there's recent information about in the last couple of days things seem to be heating up again, and yet there's no actual real change. Now, I don't know if this is true, but there was a number of reports that came over that were on the internet and on different news services about U.S. corporations selling anthrax and other chemical weapons to Iraq during the last half a year. Do you have any information about that?
I don't know. I haven't seen that. In the last half a year that they were?
Yeah, that there's been like apparently several U.S. corporations have started selling chemical and biological weapons to Iraq and somehow are not in violation of the sanctions. Now, it seems a little odd if the sanctions are over the issue of weapons of mass destruction. I don't recall the Iraq even using biological weapons in the Persian Gulf War. Am I mistaken, or did they?
Oh, there's no indication that that happened.
So it's I guess we should get more information about this anthrax. I saw a lot of traffic on the internet about that U.S. corporation selling anthrax to Iraq.
And I haven't seen the reports myself, Keith, but I'm not only skeptical. I flat out I don't believe those reports. And I'll tell you why. Iraq is banned from any imports that are not allowed, not explicitly allowed by the United Nations Sanctions Committee, which is what's called the 661 Committee. Even the oil for food deal, which is often deliberately misinterpreted in the media here as being a way in which Saddam Hussein, quote-unquote, Saddam Hussein can get more money to buy weapons of mass destruction or marble for palaces or something like that. This is all ridiculous. The way the deal works is this. Iraq is allowed to sell up to $2 million worth of oil every 6 months. About 35% of that is taken right off the top to compensate Kuwaiti, to pay reparations to Kuwaitis. Now, Kuwait, we should point out, is a country where the Kuwaitis, who are a small minority of the population, they have all foreign workers do all the work in the country, but the Kuwaitis themselves have the highest standard of living, highest per capita standard of living of any country in the world. But nevertheless, 35% goes to them. Then what's left is about 35 to 40% for them and for UN costs. So 40% goes off the top. The $1.2 billion that's left, Iraq, it never touches the money. It's deposited into a special account that the United Nations Sanctions Committee oversees. Iraq then submits contract proposals to the same committee, and they have to be approved. Now, a lot of them are not approved. About half of those contract proposals, including for powdered milk and things like this, are not approved at the insistence of the U.S. and the British representatives. The San Francisco Examiner reports yesterday that once again Iraq has been forced to cut its food rations. It's already totally inadequate food rations that are pretty equitably distributed, but there's not enough. They've been forced to cut them again because of interference in their contracts by the U.S. and the British. So when the contracts are approved, and of course favored corporations get these contracts, then it goes through a bureaucratic process of a letter of credit is issued by the sanctions committee or by the account that this money is deposited in so that the contracts can be carried out, can be executed. And so Iraq never touches this money. Other than that, the only other thing that's exempt is that Iraq is allowed to sell a certain amount of oil to Jordan, because otherwise Jordan would its economy would collapse. But that's very carefully regulated. Other than that, Iraq is not really allowed to export or import anything without UN permission.
And it's
these reports of them having contracts with U.S. companies or buying this stuff, it would have to be smuggled in.
So this would be something, could this potentially have been like an Oliver North type of situation?
Yeah, or it can just be more planted stories.
Right, just more CIA stories to give.
I suspect that's what it is. There's a lot of these. There's an unbelievable number of them that over the years, because we've worked on this issue ever since the Gulf War, many, many, many reports like this surface. They circulate in the media, and then later it turns out that they say, well, no, it wasn't true at all. But the big news is what comes up front. And the maxim in public relations circles is retractions and refutations don't matter. It's what's said first and said loudest.
Now
once you can create that impression, then everything else is secondary or not even secondary. It just doesn't matter at all. And we've been through hundreds of reports like this over the years.
Now,
I just want to say one other thing about it, if I can.
Yeah.
There's a problem about this, too, that we have to be very careful about, and that is the whole issue of dual-use technology that has the stories that have floated over the years, and that is that U.S. companies sold Iraq dual-use technology. And so somehow, you know, U.S. corporations have some responsibility and so forth. Well, that may well be true, but we don't want to fall into a trap that exists in this argument. And that is that in modern industrial society, many, many different kinds of technology have dual use. They can have a military use as well as a civilian use. The demand of the U.S. government, it's very, and if you read carefully what they say, what they've been saying is that they're not only demanding that Iraq destroy its chemical and biological weapons and other weaponry, but that it destroy the capacity to make them. And if you accept that, it would mean that they would have to destroy their chemical industry. They would have to destroy much of their agriculture industry, like the vaccination, you know, the max vaccination of farm animals that goes on to prevent disease and so forth. That can be translated into the creation of biological weapons. But many, many different forms of industry can have a military use as well. And in fact, we believe that this is an objective of the U.S., or one of the things that they're trying to do to so weaken Iraq is to de-industrialize the country, is to force Iraq back into its earlier period. And it's only been 40 years that Iraq has really had any industry at all, and which made it possible also for it to develop as a country. And there was extreme poverty before the 40 years ago in Iraq.
Yes, that's definitely, it's a, that's a pretty, it was pretty profoundly poor. Now, you have like this situation in Iraq where sometimes the United States is saying, oh, Saddam Hussein is gassing the Kurds are victims of this horrible, brutal war. And then at the other, on the other hand, the United States is providing, I think it's the largest donator of military aid to the Turkish government, which is waging a brutal war against the Kurds as well. But you, then that's important to be doing because, after all, this is the PKK and they're communists, and you need to contain this horrible threat. So the United States kind of has it both ways. Do you know anything about the state of that conflict, and is there is Saddam Hussein still waging a war against Kurds? We know for sure the United States and Turkey is waging a war against Kurds, and there's been some pretty brutal military operations recently in the Turkish section of Kurdistan. Do you know any details about that? And why is the U.S. All upset about Saddam killing Kurds but is funding the murder of Kurds in Turkey?
Right. Well, I think if you wanted to give, you know, the dictionary should all say, when it comes to the word hypocrisy, that it should say, see U.S. policy toward Kurdish people. because there's nothing. There's nothing. I don't think there's anything that surpasses for hypocrisy, duplicitness, deceit, and so forth. What the U.S. how the U.S. has treated the Kurdish issue. I mean, way back. I mean, it goes way back to, you know, the time of the end of World War One and Woodrow Wilson and the 14 points and the right of self-determination and all that. And in the first treaty after the war, after there was supposedly going to be a homeland for the Kurdish people, but by 2 years later, that it was gone. It had disappeared. And the U.S. Supported the Iranian regime in 1946 in destroying the only Kurdish regime that ever, the only Kurdish state that ever existed. The Mahabad Republic that existed in Iranian Kurdistan for 1 year, at the end of which time the leaders were all hung and so on and so forth. And this was the U.S., and the U.S. threatened the Soviet Union, which was supporting that republic, giving it some support, with we believe, with nuclear war if they didn't pull back from Iran and cease and desist from their support. the U.S. has supported different Kurdish factions, and the Kurdish people, like any people, are divided into classes and groupings and so forth. The U.S. has supported the most reactionary and feudal groupings in Kurdistan over the years, and then it has only supported them at times that it found convenient. In 1972, when the Shah was still in power in Iran, and when Iraq nationalized the oil company, the Iraqi oil, petroleum company, they had nationalized the oil fields in 58. They nationalized, completely took over the oil operations in 72. The U.S. began funding the Barzani group, the Kurdish Democratic Party, to fight against the Iraqi government. And at the time, Barzani, and this gives you a sense of who he was, said that if the Kurds won an independent homeland, they would become the 51st state of the United States. So he wasn't really that much of a nationalist in that regard. But that went on for 3 years. The U.S. pumped in military weaponry so that they had a regular army. There were armored vehicles, artillery, uniforms, machine guns, automatic weapons, all of this, so that really what existed then, right across the border, going back and forth across the border, supplied by the Shah's army as the intermediary, was a regular Kurdish army that was fighting battles against the Iraqi government. And in 1975, Iran and Iraq reached an agreement on their dispute, temporary agreement on the dispute of over the separation of the two countries, and the United States, and so as a result, the KDP, the Kurdish Democratic Party forces, were immediately cut off from military support, and this is with the U.S. agreement. So here they had been, and they had been on a very short leash. The U.S. didn't give them that much, they had enough ammunition to fight for a few days at a time. And it collapsed in complete disarray. Barzani, of course, got away, fled into exile, and he and his top lieutenants were all safe. And afterwards, the Pike Commission of the CIA posed a question to Henry Kissinger and said, well, didn't you feel like you were betraying the Kurdish people when that happened? And that's where Kissinger came up with this famous line that you shouldn't confuse the intelligence business with...
Right.
And that's, that really summarizes it. No, they have no friends. We're really talking about imperialism, about corporate imperialism. And corporate imperialism's worldwide agenda, they have no friends, they have interests. All peoples are expendable. And any people who believe that the U.S. government is their friend and supporter, and that there's something genuine about that, set themselves up for disaster. The other side of the coin, like you say, is Turkey. The repression, where most of the Kurdish people, about 60% of the Kurds in the world, live in Turkey, in the southeast part of the state, where they have been the most repressed, far more repressed than in Iraq. Iraq, when it became independent, declared itself a republic of two peoples, the Kurds and the Arab and Kurdish people. And the Kurdish language is in newspapers and in schools in that part of the country. And really, there's a little bit of a distorted picture because a lot of the high government officials in Iraq and in the parliament and living in Baghdad are, large numbers of Kurdish people. It's not all a completely separated situation. But in Turkey, all rights have been denied to Kurdish people. There's been a ferocious war. The United States has provided F-16s to Turkey, among many other weapons. But they've not only provided them with weapons, they've licensed the Turkish government to produce its own F-16s. Nobody in the world questions who those F-16s are being used against. They're being used every day against the Kurdish people who are fighting for their liberation and for an end to the terrible oppression that they've suffered under from the Turkish government. So any time that we hear the U.S. government with, little tears in the corner of their eyes, start to talk about the rights of the Kurdish people and the oppression of the Kurdish people, we should think about what Henry Kissinger said.
Now, there was, Henry Kissinger brings up an interesting point, and I know yesterday, I guess, the United States was trying to shut down, an international court because they were concerned that their own soldiers and so on might be prosecuted in this court. And we just also recently had this thing where a friend of mine, Nate Thayer, was reporting on the death of Pol Pot, and just before Pol Pot's death in Cambodia, there was all this talk about U.S. going and bringing Pol Pot to justice. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a, you know, and then we also recently had this whole great thing about the NAFTA and how Chile would be a, you know, and all these great, fantastic democracies. All, you know, Clinton had that really outrageous speech about the democracies of Latin America, all except for Cuba.
Right.
And each of these things brought to mind the name Henry Kissinger, of course, because, you know, Henry Kissinger was
right. Was
involved in you see, like, Pol Pot supposed to have, like, the Khmer Rouge supposed to have killed, like, maybe, like, the U.S. media says a couple of million people. But we kind of tend to forget that under the direction of Henry Kissinger, that there's like 3 million Cambodian deaths, 3 million or more Vietnamese deaths, and maybe a couple of million people, maybe, or several, at least hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Laotians killed under Kissinger. Now, what's the story here? Aren't we, you know, Kissinger's still alive, right? I mean, maybe they can't go get Pol Pot, but they certainly, somebody could go and get Kissinger.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's the point that you're raising is that it's the all of the forgotten history and conveniently forgotten history, and they want to talk about war crimes tribunals and so forth, but, you know, we know who should be at the top of the list for the last half century of war crimes. I mean, since the end of World War II, there's no contest about who has visited more death and destruction on peoples all over the world. I mean, we could add to the list about Kissinger. We could add East Timor. We could add Argentina, Chile. This has gone on in an earlier period. The representatives of the Democrats, it wasn't just Kissinger, it was the Johnson administration and the Nixon administration. And what went on in Indonesia, the massacres in Indonesia of 500,000 to 1 million people. This is what really, I think, characterizes the way all of this is presented to us today, is that there are human rights violators, there are rogue states, there are countries that are repressing their own people and threatening others. But to qualify to be in that group, you have to be a poor country. You have to be a developing country. No matter what the rich countries who have been the colonizers, who are the imperialist countries, no matter what they've done, they do not face sentences. They do not face war crimes tribunals. It's never even mentioned. And it really shows that we really are the victims to a large degree of a concerted and ongoing propaganda campaign that comes through the corporate media that works for these people and which is really paid to cover up their crimes. And their crimes are far too numerous, you know, go way beyond what you and I are talking about here today. They extend all over the world, and the goal has been to prevent people by any means, no means have been too brutal, to prevent people all over the world from gaining control of their own resources, to being able to create their own destiny, to have their labor and the resources of their country go to create a decent life for themselves. That's considered the worst thing possible, and that's considered the denial of freedom in Washington and in the New York Times and CBS and CNN. That's called denial of freedom. Why? Because it denies the freedom of capital to invest and to make the highest profit in those countries. And that's really what they're talking about when they talk about freedom.
Now, I just got back from the Eastern Europe, and people are not too excited about capitalism over there.
I wouldn't think so.
They were, like, a lot of people commented, oh, yeah, we thought this was going to be really good, but now that we have no money and no way to live, and we're not so excited about this. And, of course, you have, like, unfortunately, this really brutal, what's becoming a near civil war in the Eastern Bloc between fascists and neo-Nazis and a large portion of the rest of the population. And there's some very brutal battles and fights occurring in Poland, former East Germany, and throughout the Eastern Bloc. And you could see, like, when you're over there, all this traffic on the freeways or the autobahns and so on of all this commercial goods going in these trucks from all over the continent. But you have, like, these very severe blockades of, like, Polish people aren't allowed into Germany and all this kind of really horrible racism that is going on. So that you have that mix. At the same time, however, there does seem to be, not with the German government, actually, which is seems to be, at least publicly, a very strong ally of the United States, but there is starting to appear to be a number of governments that are starting to step away from this unity of how great the United States is. In my experience, I didn't find too many people that liked the U.S. basically at all, anywhere I traveled. But and in fact, you know, and I think you might have experienced the same thing. If you're a dissident in the United States, people outside of the United States just, like, totally love you, think you're the,
right,
you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread or whatever. But are you seeing yourself? I know, like, also with that when the man was executed in Virginia,
right,
and the world court had ruled against the United States, and then the United States said, well, hell with these international bodies. There seems to be a pretty strong pattern of the U.S. only, you know, they're, like, totally into the Security Council of the United UN, and so that whatever they say is great. But the second any other international organization condemns the U.S., it's like, well, we'll just ignore them. Do you think that can just continue indefinitely, that the U.S. can ignore even the governments of other countries' opinions about the U.S.?
Well, the only thing that really menaces them, I think, is the rising, what you were referring to, and that's the rising resentment all over the world toward the U.S., toward U.S. policies. And you're right, it's not toward the people in the United States, because if you're opposed to these policies, people are very happy to know you and very happy for what you're doing. But the tremendous arrogance that comes from the United States right now is increasingly opposed and resented by people all over the world. And it's got to take a form, though, not just of resentment, because that's passive, but of action. And I think that it's going to. I don't think that people, you know, there's the great thinkers are saying, well, this isn't just the 20th century is not going to be the only American century. The 21st century is going to be too, and maybe the 22nd and 23rd. I mean, I hear these things that are coming up because it's the turn of the millennium coming. All empires, and this is the biggest empire that's ever existed, has troops now in 100 countries in the world. All empires think themselves invincible. And I don't remember who said this originally, that all ruling classes think themselves invincible until history teaches them otherwise. Well, you can feel that kind of arrogance coming from the U.S. ruling class when you see them speak, and I think that's what set them up for Ohio State. They've been, you know, everyone, all in all the diplomatic circles, everyone has to bow down and scrape before them and tell them how wonderful they are and all that. And they went out and met some ordinary people in Ohio State, and they didn't know what to do.
Right.
Up officials, they were freaked out by it. You know, why are these people talking to us? Why weren't they screened out? You know, this is what kind of Democrats they really are. You know, what they really think about democracy.
Right, I know. It was outrageous, the whole, and the way that CNN tried to turn down the volume
and
turn up the volume, and they would only show video of, like, veterans of foreign wars while the
right.
people chanting were, like, totally ignored, and no one interviewed, like, you know, it was outrageous. And I think that was one of the things, I think, that freaked out people in other countries immensely,
right.
wasn't it?
And it was great because, I mean, one of the things that happened, I think that what's proof of this is that things are changing. You know, since the Gulf War, the U.S. has been riding very high, very, very high in the world, and has felt that, you know, there's all this about the end of history and all this about no one can challenge the United States and so forth. And right now, there's probably no, there is no other country that can militarily. But what can challenge them is the organized power of people. And this is the thing that they always forget about. They always drop from the ones on top. The real rulers always think that the ordinary people are, they hardly even think of them as people. They're just supposed to be little profit-creating units and or fighting units or something like that. But you could see what happened in January, and especially in February, as this rising tide of world opposition, including a pretty strong opposition inside this country, to the U.S. plans for a new bombing war against Iraq, for this U.S.-British plan that they had underway. And you could feel it. I mean, you could really feel it in the Middle East, where in Jordan and Egypt and in the parts of the areas of Palestine under the Palestinian Authority, that pro-Iraqi demonstrations were banned. And in all three of those, pro-Iraqi demonstrations happened, and they were getting stronger. And I think that even some in the administration who aren't, you know, maybe completely swept away in this arrogance that's going on, said, you know, if we bomb Iraq, we might have a new intifada, and it might not just be in Palestine. It might be in Jordan and Egypt and other countries as well. But I think you can sense it all over the world that this real anger about the free trade policies, as they call them, it's really the freedom of, they shouldn't even be called free trade. It should really be called the, you know, complete freedom for capital policies.
Right.
That they can go, that the only freedom that matters, the only thing that matters is that capital is free to reap the highest investment, and particularly that U.S. capital, that nobody interferes with U.S. capital. That's old. That's not acceptable anymore. You can't protect jobs in your country. You can't protect your own ability to produce. You can't protect your health care system. You can't subsidize food. Don't subsidize transportation. Don't do any of those things because they might interfere with the maximization of profits by U.S. companies and the other big transnational corporations.